This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Police departments around the country are seeing some difficulty recruiting new officers, and Hawaii's largest police force is no exception. The Honolulu Police Department is currently short 260 officers, about 10% of its total workforce. HPD's Chief Susan Ballard recently spoke with HPR's Ryan Finnerty about how she's trying to address that challenge.
We're no different, like on the mainland. I mean, obviously, there's a recruitment issue there. I think for the mainland, their issue is more the perception of police officers and the things that are going on over there versus here. It's more, I think, you know, like because of the low unemployment rate. And also, you know, like what I brought up is that people's perception of what an officer, who can be an officer. And I think those are probably our two biggest issues that, you know, we need to break out of so that, you know, obviously it's nothing we can do about the unemployment, but we need to do better on, you know, getting out there and letting people know that, you know, this is a job, you know, that as long as you're willing to help the community, you know, we're going to train you and, you know, do the best we can to, you know, to get you to become an officer.
On the economic front, a lot of employers are having to raise wages to deal with the low unemployment. I know that's not really something you have the freedom to do, but do you feel the compensation is competitive for this market?
I think it is. I think that, you know, the starting salary for our recruits is very competitive. And obviously, the SHOPO, the police union, is always, I think, they come up for negotiations again starting next year, and they'll be, you know, trying to negotiate, you know, additional pay raises for the, you know, for the officers. And the thing with the compensation for an officer, too, it's not just their base salary, what they start at, which is like $63,000, but there's like the standard of conduct pay, which is, you know, over $12,000 a year more. And, you know, they work holidays and they get time and a half. If they work overtime, they get time and a half. So, I mean, the amount of money that they can make during the year is quite competitive.
And it's that 260 number, that works out to about 10%, it looks
right.
Like. How big of an impact is that on your operations?
It's pretty large. And it's not just the 260 vacancies, but also the fact that, you know, the job has changed, you know, tremendously, you know, in the past, you know, 5 to 10 years. And so we also need additional, you know, personnel to address, you know, specific issues, for example, you know, the homeless issue. What it does is, like, when I came on board, the guys who were out there patrolling the streets, their strength was only, they were only operating at like 65%. And currently we are up to 80%, but that's only because we're bringing in people in overtime. So because of the shortages, then obviously it has an impact on our budget because we have to pay overtime to bring officers in. You know, and of course we are shooting for 100% because if, you know, there's supposed to be 8 officers out in the road for one district, then there should be 8 officers out there. There shouldn't just be 5 or 6, because there's a reason why you need those officers out there.
Your figure, your estimate is that for every 1,000 applicants you get, only around 100 to 125 can pass the background check and move on to testing. What are some of the common issues that are causing people to be judged ineligible?
I think, you know, obviously a lot of them is that if they had like an arrest record, if they have done drugs in the past. I mean, obviously it's not a total disqualification. It depends upon, you know, how current the drug use is. You know, I think those are probably some of the top ones. But I mean, now that 10% of the 1,000, that's the number of people who can move on. And so, from those who actually take the test to get the background checks, and then from there it's going to be whittled down even more because they have to do a physical fitness test, they have to do psychological testing. So, you know, and then obviously they have a where they've got to actually go and, you know, get their medical history done. So out of those, that doesn't necessarily mean that all 100 or 125 of those folks are going to make it and be offered a job in, you know, at the recruit class.
And I understand you were trying to recruit some maybe non-traditional candidates, social workers or people with experience in some of those newer issues that that officers are facing. Could you tell me a little bit about that?
Sure. I mean, you know, I think for the longest time, you know, people think that to be an officer, you have to be, you know, big, large and imposing, or be athletic or strong, or, you know, that type of thing, you know, and you really don't have to anymore with all the training that we give and the tools that you have, you know, to work with. So, you know, we're looking towards, I mean, obviously the retired military is a great pool, athletics is a great pool, and those who, you know, who are majoring in criminal justice is one, but I mean, like social workers, I mean, that is a great group of people because, you know, any college degree that's out there that, you know, you want to help people, a teaching degree, anything, someone with a teaching degree, I think that would make an excellent officer. We're even looking, you know, for non-traditional parts of the community, like the LGBTQ community, you know, to think about this as a career. And so we're really reaching out to, you know, so many different types of people that may not have ever thought about this as being a career before. You know, any time where you have to, you know, communicate with people or work with people, that's what we're looking for.
And how are you going about trying to recruit some of those non-traditional candidates?
We've, you know, we do presentations at the various conferences that these folks have. We've, you know, advertised. We do advertising at the UH campuses. You know, whenever I go out and do talks with the community, which is quite frequently, you know, I bring this up, and you know, there is no age. I mean, we've had people that come in too, you know, that are 40s and their 50s that come in and begin their career as a police officer. So, you know, we try, when I go out and talk, I try and, you know, get people to, you know, think about it, consider it as maybe if you wanted it even as a, you know, as a second career. You know, we encourage people, and also, too, if they're not sure, to maybe attend our Citizens Police Academy so that they might get a better understanding of what, you know, police work is really about.
I know in the military, Chief, there are signing bonuses or retention bonuses, that kind of thing. Is that something that the department is able to do?
Well, it is something that we're exploring, you know, with the city. We're going to be meeting with them to explore the idea of a signing bonus and even a longevity bonus so that every 5 years, and this is just stuff that we haven't talked to them about, but it's just ideas that we had, so that, you know, every 5 years you get a bonus, a longevity bonus, so that you stay, you know, with us, too. So we're just looking at anything that we can, you know, and looking at the mainland, what types of things that they're doing, what types of things that other companies are doing, not necessarily police departments, because, you know, obviously private corporations are really good at, you know, keeping their people and, you know, hiring and stuff. So we're looking at them and trying to find ways to encourage people to apply.
And that was going to be my next question. Have you been discussing this issue with your counterparts in either on the other counties or on cities on the mainland? Are there any departments that are really having success in addressing this recruiting issue?
Not really. Everybody seems to be having the same problem, you know, just trying to get people. And one of the other things, too, that we're looking at, which we're hoping will help, is also we're probably one of the few departments that never took lateral transfers before, whether it was from the neighbor islands or from the mainland. And so next year we should be starting a lateral transfer program. So people who are already police officers on the mainland and or the neighbor islands, you know, they can come to Honolulu, and instead of going through 6 months of training, it'll be a shortened academy, maybe about 3 months.
Chief, you mentioned that in some of those cities on the mainland, one of the big problems with recruiting is distrust of police officers.
Mm-hmm.
And I know with the Kealoha trial, have you experienced any kind of noticeable change in recruiting because it was a high-profile criminal trial associated with your department?
No, we really haven't. I think, you know, the people here in Hawaii are just, they're very forgiving. And I think once he was gone, I think people did not want to join, you know, while they were here and, you know, also, you know, initially. But I think that they see that now things are changing, and we really haven't gotten that all. I've never heard anybody say, oh, yeah, you know, because of the Kealoha case, I don't want to become an officer. I've never really ever heard that.
And that was Honolulu Police Chief Susan Ballard. You can find more information at joinhonolulupd.org.
Coming Saturday, June 15, to the Atherton Studio. Join HPR for an evening of pop tunes, bluegrass, and more with jazz ensemble Constant as the Moon, featuring the evocative sound of the erhu, the two-stringed Chinese fiddle, in a whole new context. For tickets, visit hprtickets.org or call the station during business hours. Sponsored by Amoresco.
It is the first Monday of the month, and that means we're going to take a pause from regular programming for a test of the emergency alert system.
I was filming in the Camargue Regional Park when I came across a remarkable concentration of these birds in the shallow tidal wetlands.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Dr. Rohinton Patel, located in Hawaii Kai Town Center. CT-guided dental implants and conscious sedation anesthesiology available. HawaiiPacificDental.com.
Public hearings kick off today for the latest revision of rules on how best to manage Mauna Kea. HPR's Ku'ube Hirishi joins us live in the studio this morning. Hi.
That's right. Good morning, Catherine. Yes, so this is the second round for folks who might remember. The first round was sort of late in September of 2018. So that initial public round of hearings got a lot of testimony. I think more than 100 of folks went ahead and testified. And so they want to, Board of Regents wants to sort of refine these rules and make sure that they are hearing from all stakeholders. So they're going forward with another round that starts tonight. I got to talk to Doug Simons. He's an astronomer up on Mauna Kea and has been for several decades now. He's the director of the Canada-France Hawaii Telescope. A couple of weeks ago, I actually went on a tour of Mauna Kea to sort of see what changes might have been happening on the mountain. And he said, you know, prior to this, there are no actual rules that rangers can use to enforce any sort of parking or with all the increases in tourism on the mountain, those sorts of things. And public safety is kind of his concern and a big concern for those who work on the mountain day after day. This is what he had to say.
Yeah, I think Wild Wild West is a good description of it. You know, I've seen everything from hikers to people on bicycles looking like they're about to pass out. You know, a lot of people that are up there, they're, as I said before, tourists, and they simply don't understand the risks of high-altitude driving and the environment and how harsh it is up on the summit of Mauna Kea. And I've watched that for, you know, 30 years now.
So he's saying long overdue in terms of having actual rules in place to sort of empower these rangers to do something about, you know, folks that may not be going up. One rule, for example, a draft rule that's in there proposes four-wheel drive vehicles past Halepōhaku, which is 8 miles from the summit, but sort of that mid-level facility where you can use a restroom before you get up to the summit. So if these rules do go into place, that would be something that would change. You would need a four-wheel drive vehicle to get past Halepohaku and go to the summit, because right now he's seeing, you know, the Ford the Mustangs and the convertibles going up there with really no understanding of how the weather can change instantly up there.
Right, and he is right about the high altitude sickness, because I've been up there and a colleague of mine, I think, really got affected and just couldn't think straight.
No, that's exactly. And it's something that astronomers and folks up in these telescopes actually do are familiar with, having been there for so long. But another group sort of closely watching the outcomes of these hearings are those who are protesting the development of further development of Mauna Kea, specifically with the 30-meter telescope. Kelo Hapishoda, president of Mauna Kea Anaina Ho, got to speak to her on the phone to sort of pick her brain on this latest draft round, because the initial round of public hearings, actually, most of the testimony that went through from the public had to do with whether or not these rules were going to impact the ability of these groups who would like to protest up on the mountain, if it's going to impact their ability to do so. And the rules that are in place don't directly say you cannot protest or anything like that. But there are some rules. For example, you need to apply for a permit if you're going to have a group assembly of more than 10 folks up on the mountain. And that requires, you know, takes time to get that permit in. You don't know when something's going to happen. For example, if the 30-meter telescope is beginning construction and whatnot, sending stuff up, those protesters would then need to go ahead and apply for a permit, wait for the approval, and then actually have their assembly done. That's something Pishoda sort of has, a bone to pick with.
The point is really the state needs to prove why it needs to be regulated. But they're putting the burden on us to defend ourselves. So if someone gets cited up there, they're going to have to carry the cost of proving that they were innocent here, you know? And that's shifting the burden onto the citizens of Hawaii.
So that, you know, that's another group that's going to be watching this closely. This second round, what will happen after this? So we've got meetings starting tonight in Manoa, Big Island tomorrow and Wednesday, and then Maui on Friday, which is the deadline. Midnight on Friday is the deadline for public testimony. But so far, Jesse Suki, Assistant General Counsel up at UH and who's been very involved in the administrative rules process, has said that they are surprised right now because they haven't received as many as much testimony as they did in that first round. So here's Suki.
As of today, we haven't had as many comments, that's for sure, as we had the last time. So that may be an indication that folks are generally okay with what is out there. But, you know, it could change as we get through the rules process. We might get more comments.
That's right. So I guess the two big issues that I've heard from folks on is public safety in terms of rules. It's going to be public safety and just overall access to the mountain. A bulk of the rules that haven't really gotten a lot of, attention have to deal with commercial activity, which is also increasing on the mountain. The last time I was up there, I came down after sunset. Well, the entire ridgeline where all the telescopes are, there were cars from pretty much any open spot to get a shot of the sunset and coming down the mountain, huge caravans of tourist commercial operators up there. So there are rules in there that will limit their activity and sort of have rules that will allow the, like I said, the rangers and other law enforcement officers to actually cite folks.
Right, and I know there was that controversy with the skier that went down there and posted the video on social media.
That's right. So recreational activity, as you will. Skiing is not prohibited under these new rules, but there are designated areas, and I think that was sort of the initial protest with that, what was happening there.
I just wonder, though, with some of these protest groups, if even though we have these rules, they're just going to break them, you know, civil disobedience, free speech.
Yes. No, I think that that's going to be a big something to watch as these rules sort of take place. So coming up next, the Board of Regents will, after all the testimony is gathered, if any of the rules need to be changed, they will be, and then go before the Board of Regents next month in July. And it's up to the Board of Regents. They can approve it on the spot. They can defer the decision, or they can ask for another round of public hearings. So there are multiple opportunities before the rules actually take place to continue to voice your opinion.
Okay, so we'll see what happens this week and what other testimony they get.
That's right. Thank you, Catherine.
All right. That was HPR's general reporter, Kuvehi Reishi. You can find her reports and information about the hearing schedule online at hawaiipublicradio.org. Our reality check today looks at an investigative series on our fisheries in the Pacific. Honolulu Civil Beats editor Patty Epler joins us to talk about following the money and reeling it in. Morning, Patty.
Good morning, Catherine. How are you?
Good. Now, you have a several-part series on this issue.
Yes, today is just the first day of a series on the Western Pacific Sustainable Fisheries Fund, which is a kind of obscure federal grant program that is overseen by the Western Pacific Regional Fisheries Management Council, or WESPAC, as it's been called for decades.
And so what's the issue there?
So the issue is that for about 10 years, there's been money, millions of dollars really flowing through this fund, and no one can seem to really get to the bottom of how it's being spent, who specifically is getting the money, what it's being used for, is it being used for conformance with federal law, which has more of a conservation, sustainable fishery kind of mandate. And so we've been trying for a couple of years now to get records under the Federal Freedom of Information Act, and the WESPAC has been just kind of slowly trickling them out to us. So finally got some financial information, but again, it's very broad brush. It's not the specific information we wanted. More importantly, Senator Brian Schatz asked it's been a couple of years too, because he put into the FY 2018 appropriations bill a requirement that they do an audit, but a detailed financial accounting. That was definitely lacking in detail when he got that. And now two congressmen, Ed Case from Hawaii and Gregorio Sablan from CNMI, the Northern Mariana Islands, are now asking questions about it as well.
So the voices are getting louder. They want more transparency.
They do. And, you know, as Ed Case has articulated pretty well in our series, what's at stake here is the sustainability of our fisheries resource. So if you can't really figure out what this money's going for and what it's, if it's being spent in order to conserve the resource or make it sustainable and not just exploit the fishery for the longline tuna fishermen that are all based here in Hawaii, then we just don't know. There's like a broader sort of health of the oceans issue at stake here.
Now, WESPAC's executive director, Kitty Simons, and she's been there for decades, if I recall.
So she testified in Congress on May 1st that she's been the executive director for 37
yes.
years.
Yeah. I recall her time on there when I lived in Guam. So, yeah, she's been on board for a long time.
Yeah, and so WESPAC, as you know, oversees not only Hawaii and the remote sort of far northwestern Hawaiian Islands type areas, but also the CNMI, Guam, and American Samoa.
And so I guess map out for our listeners today, you kind of laid out on the table, you know, the calls for more transparency. What else is on tap for the next couple of days?
So the next couple of days looks a little more closely. Nathan Eagle, one of our reporters, went down to America and Samoa last month and sort of looked around at what some of the projects that have been paid for with this money and how well, or as it turns out, not so well, they're doing. The third day of the series looks at sort of WESPAC's reluctance to release records going back decades. There's been lots of lack of transparency, we'll just say with that. But I think one of the things that we found, just in the limited amount of records that we could get this time around, and we're still asking, by the way, we still have federal FOIAs in for, you know, detailed ledgers and all sorts of stuff. But, you know, you can see that money is going to people who are on the council itself, you know, like tens of thousands, if not millions of dollars, including some of the council members who are active in, say, American Samoa's fisheries, are kind of in the loop of approving projects that are then personally benefiting their own companies. So we've noticed that. There's also some contracts that we've found that have gone to people who are political allies of Kitty Simons and her, say, opposition to opening up the Marine National Monument or expanding the Marine National Monument. So, again, this stuff goes back like 10 years. It's not just the recent stuff that's happening. So it's very hard to kind of sort through it when there's so much resistance on the part of Westpac to just sort of open up their, you know, financial records.
Okay, so looking at possible conflicts and maybe what need to be the best practices.
Yes, definitely. Right. There's, yes, that for sure.
All right. Well, thanks so much, Patty.
Thank you. Talk to you again.
All right. That was Honolulu Civil Beat editor Patty Epler with today's Reality Check. To read the full series, visit civilbeat.org. A new deep-diving sea record was broken by Dallas businessman and explorer Victor Vescovo last month. We're talking about the deepest ocean trench located just next to the island of Guam. University of Hawaii geologist Patty Fryer was asked to go along as a scientific advisor on the expedition. We first met Patty following a dive with filmmaker James Cameron. She talked about how that compared to this recent dive.
I was privileged to be invited to go along with James Cameron, the director of such movies as Avatar and Titanic. And he also is a person who is excited about exploring the oceans. So he had, with a group of colleagues, assembled a group of people to build a submersible for himself in order to be able to take himself and hopefully others to the bottom of the deepest parts of the world's oceans. So in 2012, along with Ron Allam, who designed the sub, he and a group of his cohorts went to sea and dove progressively deeper and deeper places to test out the sub for a while. And ultimately, they took it to the Challenger Deep, which is the deepest part of the Mariana Trench in the Western Pacific. And I had been available for leading some expeditions to that area and doing some mapping of the seafloor. So we had actually, in 2009, gone out with the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution's group that had designed a full ocean depth remotely operated vehicle. This is a vehicle that's basically a robot on a tether or electrical cable that would provide it with the ability to control from the ship what you would do on the seafloor. So they took that vehicle down to the Challenger Deep, and we drove it around in the deepest part of the flat-floored portion of the trench. And we brought back a couple of rocks that I was able to analyze when we got back to shore. And so we had a real good map of the deepest part of the Challenger Deep. The Challenger Deep is actually three ponds separated by two ridges into three separate compartments. And in 1960, the Trieste bathyscape went down in the western part, the westernmost of those three ponds, with Don Walsh and Jacques Picard. And they dove successfully and returned to the surface of the ocean and then got towed back to Guam. So we went with Cameron's expedition from Guam down to the Challenger Deep and then back to Guam afterward. And I had been looking at the samples that we discovered there and found some very interesting things about them. In fact, most scientists think that the Pacific Plate, which is at most about 180 million years old, is being subducted. In other words, it's sort of diving down beneath the Mariana Island Arc. So there's a boundary between the two tectonic plates there. So Pacific plate is moving westward beneath the Mariana Islands. And most people think that all the way along the entire Mariana Trench, it's the Pacific plate that's diving. But the rocks that I got back from the cruise with the Nereus vehicle are actually much, much younger, according to the ages we've got. So I think, and I'm working on this, I'm trying to put together a paper that's going to say that there's a new tectonic plate that had not previously been discovered just to the west of Guam and south of the Mariana Trench.
And that's really exciting for someone who studied rocks.
For sure. Yeah. And what's really cool about those particular rocks is that when you look at it in the microscope, you can see trails where microscopic animals have bored into the previous minerals in the rock, and basically they're eating the minerals. So people have talked about this before, that alteration of rocks can take place in the presence of and maybe caused by microbes that are boring into these things.
Now, because of your expertise in the trench, you were also tapped in as a scientific advisor for this latest expedition, which again broke some records.
Yes, indeed. I was just thrilled to get an email from a colleague of mine, Alan Jameson, who is one of the two chief scientists on this expedition for Victor Vescovo. And Alan said, would you like to come back and have some fun in the Mariana Trench? And I said, well, yes, of course. So when we left Guam, we went immediately to the Mariana Trench, and Victor's first dive, as you can see, actually, if folks want to go on the World Wide Web and look at 5deeps.com, they can see some of the results of the various dives that Victor has done already with the new submersible. This is a really cool sub. It's one that can take a pilot and a passenger down. So Alan actually was able to dive with Victor in the very last of the dives that took place in the Mariana region.
So it's a larger sub than what James Cameron went down on.
It's a very different shape. You know what? I'm not actually sure what the overall dimensions are by comparison.
But you can fit two people in there.
But you can fit two people in there, that's right.
Okay. And can you say what you discovered down there?
Not yet. I didn't actually dive in the sub during this expedition, but I did get to crawl into it at the very end and look around inside. But what's really exciting about it is that it totally worked, you know? I'm just so blown away by the fact that through the last 40 years, you know, that I've been working at the University of Hawaii and studying the Mariana region, I have seen the progression now from dredging rocks up off the seafloor, taking remotely operated vehicles to the deepest part of the Mariana Trench, the deepest part of the world's oceans, and seeing James Cameron for the first time take a manned submersible down there that he could drive around, explore the place, and now Victor Vescovo's submersible is capable of taking two people repeatedly. So it's obvious now that we are able, as a community of human beings, to explore any place on this planet.
And we should say the trench is like 12 miles deep, right? At its deepest,
yeah,
is that right?
That's about right. Almost 11,000 kilometers.
And it's really, so thanks to technology, we're able to do this exploring and retrieve samples and study them.
That's true. Yeah.
And learn about our Earth.
That's right. And there's so much we don't know. That's the thing. We know so much less about the bottom of the ocean than we do by comparison with the surface of the moon.
Now, James Cameron documented his journey.
That's true.
And the same is being done with this latest expedition.
Absolutely. That's going to be exciting. Discovery Channel is putting together a documentary that will cover all of this expedition, including all of the dives that Victor and the Triton Submersibles Group is going to be involved in.
Yeah, so folks can look forward to that, what, later this year?
Yes. We're expecting maybe toward December. It should be public.
Okay. And then, you know, I know for the time that I've known you, and you talked about your trips to Guam, and you talked about the work with the school kids.
Yeah, that was fun. I was good friends with Linda Tatro in Guam, and she was a high school teacher for basically marine science of all sorts. She's just an amazing character. And she put together a competition for the local schools, the high schools, and the kids would get together sort of a trivia contest, a series of competitions. They would kind of compete with one another, and then the winning team would get a prize, the grand prize. And what Linda and I put together was to let the kids name some feature on the seafloor that had been mapped. And then that name would be given to the worldwide naming convention for seafloor features. So the kids have named mountains on the seafloor, ridges, a volcano that has this gigantic crater right in the center of it. And one of the things that I thought was the coolest name that they gave it was the Malagana Gadao Spreading Center. And the story behind this was supposed to be something to do with Chamorro history or culture or with legends. And this particular one was named for two very strong chiefs in the traditions of Chamorro culture that were so powerful that they would fight with one another. So because this was a spreading center that they were naming, they chose the Malagana Gadao name because these two chiefs, each of whom were represented by one of those names, were in a canoe together, and they decided one wanted to go one way, one wanted to go the other way, and they were paddling so hard they ripped the canoe apart. I think that's a great story.
Yeah. Well, that's neat, but bringing a culture and connecting it to the earth in the area that it's...
Yeah, Catherine, you know, I think the thing that's important is that this gives the children of Guam a sense of ownership of the wonders on the seafloor around them. I mean, the Mariana region is one of the most interesting convergent margins between two tectonic plates that I can think of. There's so many strange things going on there and unique things. And here the kids own many of those features now.
Yeah, well, it's a fascinating area. Thank you for your work down there and helping to kind of unravel the mysteries of the deep.
Oh, you're quite welcome.
That was UH geologist Patty Fryer, just back from a deep sea adventure in the Marianas. For links to the expedition, head to hawaiipublicradio.org. Stay with us. We'll be right back after the monthly Civil Defense Siren Test. In a nod to Princess Kaiulani, we explored her Scottish roots in a story last week. Today, we take you to the English seaside, where the young Hawaii royal spent years, several years, under the watchful eye of governess Phoebe Brooke. Jane Caudry teaches creative media at the college in Brighton and Hove. She used the princess's story to teach her students a bit of the town's connection with the islands and produce an art film entitled A Princess in Hove. It was through the eyes of Kaiulani's governess and took us to the flat where she once lived with the princess. Take a listen.
Young lady. She was barely 17. A child. Her mother dead. Sent over from Hawaii to learn how to become a lady. A queen. Well, I'd assured Mr. Davis, her guardian, that nothing would be left to chance. My preparation of a future monarch, albeit one from a tiny group of Pacific islands, would be exact in every department. I would at all times, and in every way, remain diligent as to the import of my role. But she was still a child, for all that. I was told later after everything that happened, of how she had first described me in a letter to her aunt. Mr. Davis has kindly found a lady who will look after
and be a sort of mother to me while I am in Brighton.
Jane Caudry's film was screened last summer in France as part of the 25th anniversary of Halau Hula Omanoa, a Paris halau which traveled to Brighton to teach a hula created in honor of the princess. It was performed at a pavilion on the shoreline. Director Jane Caudry recalls the making of the film.
She was so very young when she was here, and it was quite a special time in her life. And, you know, it was a very long way from home. It must have seemed very strange and very different to her. And I just sort of felt an empathy for her. And I felt that people in Brighton and Hove needed to know about it. And Brighton is a place where I think it's always attracted interesting people. We have quite a collection of eccentric people who have lived here over the years. And it's part of the story that I felt people needed to know about, really.
And I know when I visited Brighton and went through the pavilion, you know, I can just imagine what it was like for the princess when she lived there for several years.
Yes. I mean, it was very different back then, of course. I mean, 1892, it was, you know, it was not really much more than a village at the time. Brighton was made famous by George IV, who came here and made it a resort town. So people used to come here and take the waters and come for the health. And I think it was, you know, a place that she came for her education, and it was before she came out officially. So she was never officially presented to Queen Victoria. So she was sort of slightly under the radar while she was here. She wasn't, you know, in the newspapers as such. It was a time where, you know, it was all about her education. I felt that she formed a very special relationship with Phoebe Rook. And my little film is, we were trying to present that, really, because I think for Phoebe Rook, who was all about education, she sort of committed herself to trying to help the princess who was intended to be queen. And I think it was quite a special relationship between the two of them.
And so what was it like filming in the actual unit where she lived?
It was very special. We were in, it was very, you know, it was very kind of the people who lived in that house to let us to use their apartment. It was really lovely just being in that part of Brighton and Hove where she would have been, the street she would have used, the church she would have gone to, and the walk down through the gardens to the seafront where you've got the little pavilion, which she would have known, you know, and you can't help but feel a sort of connection to her and the sea looking out. Hawaii must have felt like a very long way away. It felt quite special. And as you know, we did a little performance of the dance in the pavilion on the seafront with some girls from Brighton City College, where I teach. And, you know, for them, Hawaii is a long way away. And I think it was very special for them to be involved with the dance and to learn something that was very new and very different. I think it felt very special for them.
Right, because they were about the same age that the princess was when she lived down in Brighton.
That's right, yeah. About the same age as the princess. And, you know, their lives are very different. But I think it was nice for them to have this sense of a connection with somebody from a long time ago. To have that connection felt quite special. I teach in a college for students sort of 16 to 19. It was great to get everybody involved. So we had students doing makeup and doing the photography, helping with the dance and helping with the filming and the editing. It was very much a felt like a community project. So they gained quite a lot from doing it.
Did you have a little screening there in Brighton when you finished
yes,
the
we
film?
Did. Yes, yes, we did. Yes, we screened both the films. And we were part of the Brighton Festival in May. That would have been year before last. Yeah.
Okay, but we have yet to really
screen it here and you have to come.
Well, I'd love to, but it is a long way away. Yes, I'd love to come and screen it in Hawaii. And it'll be interesting to look at other parts of her story, like you mentioned Jersey and the part of the life which was in Paris, which I think was also very important. And, I'd be very interested to see Hawaii, obviously, is a key part of the story. You know, she was a young woman who was very brave, and she had to put her, you know, she was perhaps quite naturally shy and reticent, but had to be very brave and put herself forward to speak up for herself and her country, which I think was an important connection to make with the young people here. Other than that, I think, it was a very enjoyable and fantastic part to be something to be part of, really.
Right, because you were able to bring that bit of history alive again.
I think so, yeah. Yeah.
Tell us what it was like when you were able to actually track down the apartment where she lived.
Well, I just went and knocked on the door and said, hello, do you know that there used to be a Hawaiian princess that lived in your house, which obviously they didn't, and were quite surprised and delighted. It sounds very exotic and quite different it's just not what you expect. And the young couple who lived there were very welcoming and open, and allowed us to come in and film in the apartment and to look around, which was great. We filmed there. We filmed in the streets locally, and we showed the film and a small exhibition at Hope Museum of the artwork that had been involved in the film. And it meant that local people were able to come and visit and learn a little bit about the princess and her time here, which was very successful.
So it was well received.
Yes, it was. Yes. Yeah. No, it's had a lot of interest, which has been really good.
Well, hopefully you can get over here someday.
I'd love to.
And any plans for part two?
Well, I don't know, really. It would be interesting to look at other parts of her life. And, we have a fourth plinth. I don't know whether you know about it. In London, they have temporary exhibitions often in the fourth plinth, which is where the statues in Trafalgar Square. But we have a plinth in Hove. And I was thinking it would be lovely to have the statue of the princess here. So maybe that's a project that I could look at trying to raise interest in that.
And that was Jane Coldry, who produced an art film about Princess Kaiulani's time in Brighton, England, told through the eyes of her governess. To learn more, check out hawaiipublicradio.org. And we close out with a snippet of the film.
Kaiulani, princess. I will write you a poem for your going away here in your pocketbook. I will read it to you in the shade of the mighty banyan tree. It is to remind you of your island home, so that when you come to the land of your father and the rain beats upon the window, as it surely will, you will be minded to recall the soft showers and gentle warmth of your Hawaii. Remember your people, your friends, and remember me, your humble poet, Robert Louis Stevenson. Forth from her land to mine she goes, the island maid, the island rose, light of heart and bright of face, the daughter of a double race. Her islands here in southern sun shall mourn their Kaiulani gone, and I, in her dear banyan shade, look vainly for my little maid.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Coming up in the next On Point, the USA Gymnastics sexual abuse scandal showed the vulnerability of young athletes and their families. A new Olympic abuse prevention policy goes into effect later this month, but critics say it's flawed. That's coming up in the next On Point from NPR.
This afternoon at 2, right after The World.
We do have to go, but up tomorrow, we look at the princess's time in Paris. We'd like to hear from you. Call our talk back line, leave your comments. Call 808-792-8217. Email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Post your comments on Facebook at The Conversation HPR or tweet us at HI Conversation. And if you missed any of the show or want to find a past one, find them on The Conversation page. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow, won't you, for more of The Conversation.